News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Welcome back. Today is Friday, February 3rd, and I'm Sharon Nadeem.
And I'm Andrew Seal. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to the listeners of our podcast and newscast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
To start the show, we have News 101 co-director Seher Asaf's interview with AMS Refugee Relief on their plans to sponsor a group of young Syrian refugees.
Following that, we have Rohit Joseph, Sharon Nadeem, and Andrew Seal's report on the demonstration at the Peace Arch on the Canada-US border in the wake of the Trump travel ban.
Next up is News 101 co-director Andrew Seal's interview with Chris Arsenault, inaugural visiting professor in forestry issues at UBC's School of Journalism.
After that, we have an on-the-scene report from the vigil for the victims of the Quebec mosque attack by News 101 reporter Kirthana Sasidharan.
Finally, we have Alex Norman's weekly financial report.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, the University Boulevard neighborhood is opening this spring. The new building will be a center for living, working, and studying, and was designed to function as a hub for transportation. The building, called Central, is a brand new six-story student rental area. Move-ins for the building will start in spring and commercial ventures will become available in the summer of 2017. Student-level shops include Bow Down, Jam Jar, JJ Bean, Joe Pizza, Nori, Rain and Shide, and Taco Mio. The Nest, the UBC Aquatic Center, the Student Recreation Center, the Alumni Center, and both bus loops are all located in U Boulevard neighborhood. The Student Union building is planned to be upgraded with the U Boulevard expansion and will be known as the UBC Life Building once it opens again in fall 2017. UBC students held a vigil for the victims of the Quebec mosque shooting this Tuesday. Dozens of people were there to show support at the event organized by Professor Anne Murphy of the Asian Studies Department. She said that the vigil was, quote, in response to the grief and harm of what happened in Quebec, but also knowing its connections to larger things happening in our world today, unquote. Participants sang songs, recited prayers, and discussed methods of improving the situation in Canada. Communities across the country have held their own ceremonies to show respect and support. An additional vigil, organized by UBC student Abu Bakr Khan, is scheduled on Saturday at Jackpool Plaza from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. Khan commented that, quote, the internet does not have borders, so the hate that is spooning across the world is easy to obtain, unquote.
In local news, a local startup is close to launching an Uber-like service. Ripe TX has already applied for 150 taxi licenses and released an app with features nearly identical to Uber. Ripe Rides is seeking to capitalize on one of the last major cities in North America without Uber. The local startup says it will follow BC's laws on rates, accreditation, and insurance. The company launched in December 2015 with 20 luxury sedans for hire and an app allowing users to track the vehicle, see who the driver is, and pay for the trip. Although functioning similarly to Uber, the current service is limited in scope and used only by businessmen. Uber is still campaigning to the provincial government to be allowed to operate in BC. RIPE TX Director of Business, Nitesh Mistry, says, quote, "At the end of the day, what we have applied for are taxi licenses. What we have applied for is no different than what Uber could do right now," unquote. The government hasn't announced any legislation on ride-sharing, but the minister in charge of consultations regarding the regulations of these services has said they are looking for a made-in-BC solution. A Vancouver pharmacy is suing its former manager over allegations that he used an unapproved device to administer a drug to a patient having an overdose. The lawsuit, which was filed in BC Supreme Court by Lab Pharma Health Solutions Incorporated, claims that once the naloxone nasal spray was dispensed by Amin Jan Mohammed, the patient experienced a severe reaction. The incident took place in the downtown east side at OnSite, a treatment facility above the InSight supervised injection site. At that time, Jan Mohammed, a pharmacist, was managing Lab Pharma and its contract at OnSite. According to the notice of civil claim, Jan Mohammed was developing a device for the nasal delivery of naloxone, a medication used to treat overdosing patients during the time of the incident. The lawsuit also claims that Jan Mohammed told Dan Small, former director of the Portland Hotel Society, which is responsible for InSight, that his conduct was not wrongful because the use of the device had been authorized by Dr. Ron Joe. Dr. Joe, a physician in addictions treatment and harm reduction community, denied the claim that the use of the device and drug had been authorized by him. The lawsuit says, quote, "Dr. Joe and another doctor, Dr. Siavash Jafari, reported Jan Mohammed and Lab Pharma to the BC Ministry of Health, alleging fraud and that Jan Mohammed and Lab Pharma constitute a danger to the public," unquote. The lawsuit contains allegations that have not been tested in court and no response has been filed to the suit at the moment.
In national news, there were calls for tolerance at the Montreal funeral for the men killed in the Quebec City mosque attack. On Thursday, several thousand people gathered at the Maurice Richard Arena in Montreal for the funeral service for three of the six victims in Sunday's Quebec City mosque shooting. The service was held for Khalid Belkacemi, Abdelkarim Hassan, and Abu Bakr Tabti, who were honored before their bodies are repatriated to their countries of origin. In a show of solidarity, one by one, political leaders and representatives from the Muslim community spoke of the importance of coming together. Quote, "It is with a heavy heart that we come together this afternoon to grieve the loss of these innocent lives," unquote, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said. Quote, "But as a community and country, together we will rise from this darkness, stronger and more unified than ever before," unquote. At times, the atmosphere resembled a political rally with applause after calls for unity. The shooting has prompted soul-searching in Quebec about the tone of news media coverage and political debate about Muslims. Alexander Bissonnette, 27, has been charged with six counts of first-degree murder and five counts of attempted murder in connection with the attack, which also left 19 injured. The caskets of the three men honored Thursday were draped in wreaths and flags of their homelands. Thapli, 44, was a pharmacist of Tunisian origin who had three children. Belkacemi, a 60-year-old father of two, was from Algeria and a professor at Laval University. Hassan, 41, also from Algeria, was a father of three and worked in information technology for the provincial government. There were also prayers at the service for the other three men killed in the mosque attack, Mamadou Tanou Barry, Ibrahima Barry, and Azadine Soufian, who will be remembered at a service in Quebec City on Friday. A representative from the Muslim community said she's hopeful the attack will provoke reflection about the dangers of Islamophobia. Quote, "Sometimes bad things can lead to good results," unquote, said Aziza Balili, head of the Fédération des Canadiens Musulmans. Quote, "The empathy shown by so many fellow Canadians comforts us and allows us to hope that there will be real change," unquote. Mayor Denise Coderre, who helped organize the public funeral, said it was a chance to show solidarity with the victims and their families. Quote, "We lost six Quebecers, six Canadians," unquote, he said. Quote, "We are all brothers and sisters. We are all in mourning," unquote. The opposition is accusing Prime Minister Trudeau of betrayal as the Liberals abandon their promise of electoral reform. Trudeau's Liberal government is abandoning a commitment to reform the federal election system. A new mandate letter issued to the Minister of Democratic Institutions, Karina Gold, released publicly on Wednesday, says, quote, "Changing the electoral system will not be in your mandate," unquote. Quote, "There has been tremendous work by the House of Commons Special Committee on Electoral Reform, outreach by members of Parliament by all parties, and engagement of 360,000 individuals in Canada through mydemocracy.ca, unquote, Trudeau writes in his letter to Gold. He further added, quote, "A clear preference for a new electoral system, let alone a consensus, has not emerged. Furthermore, without a clear preference or a clear question, a referendum would not be in Canada's interest. Changing the electoral system will not be in your mandate," unquote. Karina Gold was appointed Minister of Democratic Institutions last month, replacing Mariam Monsef. Quote, "Our view has always been clear. Major reforms to the electoral system, changes of this magnitude, should not be made if they lack the broad support of Canadians," unquote, Gold told reporters at a news conference convened to comment on her new mandate letter. Quote, "It has become evident that the broad support needed among Canadians for a change of this magnitude does not exist," unquote, said Gold. Trudeau first committed to replacing the current first-past-the-post electoral system in June 2015, shortly before the federal election campaign. His government's first throne speech promised that the Liberals would take action to ensure that 2015 will be the last federal election conducted under the first-past-the-post voting system. A special committee of the House of Commons was struck last June, and all MPs were invited to hold town hall meetings on electoral reform. In addition, previous Minister Monsef conducted her own national tour and launched an online survey about the Canadian political system. Quote, "It is a difficult conversation to talk about how we govern ourselves, but we have always listened to Canadians and this will not be part of my mandate," unquote, said Gold. In a question period, NDP leader Tom Mulcair called Trudeau's actions a massive political deception. In response, Trudeau pointed to a difference of opinions among the major political parties. Quote, "As people in this House know, I have long preferred a preferential ballot. The members opposite in the NDP wanted proportional representation. The official opposition wanted a referendum," unquote, he said, gesturing towards the Conservatives. Quote, "There is no consensus. There is no clear path forward. It would be irresponsible to do something that harms Canada's stability," unquote, he added.
In international news, Donald Trump signed an executive order that bars the citizens of seven Muslim-majority countries from entering the U.S. The countries impacted are Syria, Iran, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, Yemen, and Iran. The order also suspends the United States refugee system for 120 days, including refugees from Syria. There were reports of green holders who are legal residents of the U.S. being turned away at the airport. The ban immediately sparked protests across the country, with thousands of people taking to the airports with slogans of "Let them in" and "Refugees are welcome." At least 109 people were detained at the airports, but advocates say the number could be more. Media sources reported on several stories of people stranded in various countries and airports because of the sudden ban. The state of Washington has already filed a lawsuit against President Trump on the grounds of the ban being unconstitutional. Several world leaders, including Canada, have spoken out against the ban, reiterating their commitments to welcome refugees. Tensions are escalating in eastern Ukraine as the Kremlin and Kiev trade blame. After nearly 2 years of relative calm, Ukraine's war with Russian-backed rebels took a dramatic turn this week with intense shelling in the government-controlled town of Avdiivka. The industrial town has seen heavy artillery and multiple Grad rocket launches targeted towards civilian areas. The shelling has pushed the town to the brink of a humanitarian catastrophe, leaving nearly 20,000 people without electricity, heat, or water. The region is also experiencing a particularly frigid cold spell that's seen temperatures drop to minus 22 degrees at night. The European Union called for the fighting to stop immediately, saying it violated a ceasefire and put civilians at a grave risk. The U.S. State Department issued a statement expressing deep concern about the renewed violence and calling for an immediate, sustained ceasefire. The U.N. Security Council said it would meet in closed session on January 31st to discuss the situation at Ukraine's request. Protesters in Romania held a huge demonstration over a government decree that could potentially free corrupt officials. An estimated 250,000 people took to the streets on Wednesday against the emergency decree. This is one of the largest demonstrations in the country since the fall of communist rule in 1989. The protest was fueled by the fact that the governing PSD party passed an emergency decree in a special cabinet meeting held at almost 10 p.m. without announcing the plan publicly. On the streets, the chant, "At night like thieves," could be heard. European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker has sent a letter to the Romanian Prime Minister that warns against setbacks in the country's fight against corruption. In an unprecedented move, six key partners of Romania, the U.S., Canada, Germany, France, Belgium, and the Netherlands, have issued a joint diplomatic statement warning that this decree undermines the very principles of EU and NATO membership. In response to days of protests, the government has defended its actions, saying the changes will bring the criminal code in line with recent constitutional court rulings and ease prison overcrowding, claims disputed by many senior judicial figures.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m. at CITR 101.9 FM. Profiling music and musicians take the route of positive action over apathy.
Oh, man. What?
Now we have News 101 co-director Seher Asaf's interview with AMS Refugee Relief on their plans to sponsor a group of young Syrian refugees.
And how did it come to be?
Okay, so as a student in my third year, I was just kind of overwhelmed by what was going on in Syria and just consistent media attention towards the issue. And I'd heard about it and heard about it again. And scrolling through Facebook, I'd see Humans of the New York Post. And the one that really struck me was Abdullah Kurdi, the father of the three-year-old refugee that was found on a beach dead. And just looking at that and kind of the juxtaposition between that and my everyday life, which was a lot of school, a lot of academics, and I just sort of realized that we live in a very preoccupied culture and that we need to mobilize. So I attended a lecture by Dr. Dan Hebert in the Geography Department about refugee relief and had the idea that we need to start a student group. We need to mobilize people together and find a way to help. And I met many other interested individuals at the lecture, including Katrina, who's very passionate about private sponsorship, and Lily and lots of other girls there. And I just literally walked up to one of them at one point and said, "We need to start a group." And she said, "We need to. I'm passionate about private sponsorship. Let's do this." So four or five of us started meeting together, and it just grew from there.
So let's talk about the Syrian refugee family you sponsored in October 2015. So you kickstarted the process in 2015. So where are these people now? And can you talk a little bit about who these people are?
Absolutely. So when we began the sponsorship, which is also in conjunction with St. Helens Anglican Church, and a married couple who are very, very passionate about the cause and have done a lot of fundraising, the family of eight at that point were living in a canvas tent in Beirut. So a very isolated area. They had to pay rent for the tent, even though it was just kind of a put-together shack. They were lonely. They were really eager to get out of there and to come to freedom, to come to safety. So seven of the 10 are here now. And why I say 10 is that two babies were born in the process. Seven are arrived. Three are arriving within the week, if I understand correctly. And they are settled in different rental houses quite close to the UBC campus. Mm-hmm. And I had the opportunity to meet one of the refugees.
So when did they arrive in Canada?
They started arriving in October of 2016 and then just staggered in groups of their individual families. So it's four siblings,
So what was that experience like, meeting them in person after going through such a lengthy sponsorship process?
Seeing him face-to-face, it was really powerful and just really made me think about how many other tens of thousands of people are in those shoes and don't have a way to come. And just seeing someone and looking into their eyes and thinking, wow, what must you have seen? What must you have experienced and felt? And what could have been if this private sponsorship program in Canada, which is unique to Canada, didn't exist? What might have happened? It really is quite striking.
So based on your interactions with them, how are they finding Vancouver so far?
They love Vancouver. No, I was, yeah. We were sitting on the pier at one point in Granville Island and just looking out to all the boats, and it was dark out at that point and all the lights everywhere, and how do you like Vancouver? And he said, the people are so nice here, and he says it's quiet, and we were like, what do you mean it's quiet? But he's like, no, it's quiet compared to what he's used to, and just I think the nature, like how cool the air and all these just little details that you wouldn't normally notice as a Vancouverite, are really stood out to them. And we're looking for people right now to help babysit or to help just go on excursions, learn the bus system, learn the transit system, which is hard enough to navigate as a student, never mind coming in and not speaking English, etc. So yeah, it's quite a process for sure.
So this young man that you met, he's 20 years old, is that correct?
21.
21, yeah. Okay. So what are kind of his hopes and fears for the future?
He wants to, if I remember correctly, to be a lawyer. So that involves schooling for sure. So he's doing English language classes 3 days a week, and his English is just exceptional. Even when he first arrived in October, definitely still learning, still kind of struggling with the conversational knowledge, but since then it's just growing and growing, and he's so eager to learn, just studying for hours. But his future is bright. There's absolutely no doubt to me that it's bright. And in terms of fears, we have kind of talked about that, there was a girl who was with our group at Granville Island who speaks Arabic, and I would say, well, ask this, or what about this? And he doesn't really talk too much about what happened in Syria or his fears necessarily. I think maybe that might be a bit of a cultural difference too, or maybe just the fact that that's really personal and that's really heavy and that's not something that's easy to talk about. But he's definitely courageous and definitely like one of the most kind of warm people that I've encountered.
So last year you started supporting a group of young people in their 20s, and they're currently in Turkey right now, is that correct?
Yes, so this is a really cool story, because right around the time that the sponsorship of the first family of 10 was coming to a close, because with the whole community, the church, the sponsors, our group, we exceeded the goal of 72,000 quite significantly, and things are going well. But so we got an email. There was a girl who had found and identified our student group who was working at an NGO in Turkey. So she knew of these four young adults and asked if we might consider pursuing a private sponsorship. Our group was looking for another family or another group to sponsor as students independently this time. So the timing was almost quite serendipitous, I would say. And so we've been working very, very, very hard to fundraise for the four young adults. So they're Mustafa and Lama, who are 29 and married. Mm-hmm. So they met in elementary school. The husband has a biochemistry degree. The wife is so talented at arts and craftsmen. There's also Ola and Iman, who are 26 and 19. Iman's really, really wanting to pursue her studies in poetry and music further. Yeah, and Ola is just an amazing person, very bold. You walk into the room and feel her presence, is what I'm told. And there, what's actually really neat about all four young adults is they are working at an NGO helping other Syrian children, counseling and encouraging and teaching lessons. But at the same time, of course, they are eager to move forward and come to Canada. And because it's quite, I would imagine, quite lonely to just be kind of in a transition period in a country that's not your homeland, and having great aspirations for the future but not being able to fulfill them.
Have you interacted with them personally?
I haven't, but one of the group members, Katrina, has been in close contact with the girl who put them in contact with us via Skype and via email. And so she's a member of our group now as well. And so it really has been a team effort.
So how long will it take to bring this group of people to Canada?
So that depends on two factors. Firstly, it depends on fundraising. So we are currently trying to fundraise $40,000. We've exceeded $6,000 at this point. So the first component is fundraising. And secondly, we're still looking for a private sponsorship agreement holder. So in Canada, there's a few different options for refugees to arrive, a group of five, et cetera. that the best option, but we're looking for a church or a faith group or a community organization who's willing to participate with us in that. And then beyond that, it's just a question of processing, of filling out the paperwork, which they're working very quickly to do in Turkey on their end. So, and then from that, just hoping that legislation stays open and allows them to, like, there's a lot of backlog right now because though there's so many Syrian refugees, there's still refugees from many, many, many countries around the world that are needing solace as well.
Mm-hmm. So was this through, like, a GoFundMe page?
Yeah, so we have a YouCaring page set up, and the story in detail is there if anyone wants.
Do you have any advice for anyone thinking of bringing refugees via the private sponsorship program?
It's hard. It's really, really hard, and I say that because it requires commitment to really follow through. So I think my advice would be, first of all, to not be afraid to make connections, to reach out to people you don't know. So if you have a professor on campus that teaches a subject relating to this, if you know of any sort of faith-based organization, or Mosaic Vancouver is phenomenal with refugee and resettlement services, post on Facebook. Don't be afraid to spread your voice about this. That's how we raised over 2,000 in the past 2 or 3 days, is by actively deciding that every person in our group would share the link, and then that leads to donation upon donation upon donation. So it really is a willingness to be vocal, a willingness to follow through with commitment, and a willingness to really get your hands dirty with the paperwork, go into it. It's all laid out very nicely on the Government of Canada website, but it's...
So after these refugees move to Canada, how much involvement is expected from the private sponsor in helping them transition? Like, what are the different things that you have to help out with?
Yeah, you have to help out first and foremost by finding an appropriate housing for the family or for the couple. So that involves looking at rental places and also considering neighborhoods. Would the refugees like to be by a mosque? Would they like to be by the private sponsor who helped them come, whom they know? Would they like to be downtown? Would they like to be in a more quiet area? Like, there's lots of variables that can be considered. And then beyond that, access to healthcare, access to transportation. I mentioned the transit system before, English second language classes, food. There's a list that's posted on the government website.
So how can UBC students help out?
First of all, directly with our group, as mentioned before, you could give a cash donation of any amount, $5, $10, $20, $50, whatever you like, on the UCaring website, which you can access on our Facebook, AMS Refugee Relief at UBC. And then secondly, we are having an event called Sound for Syria on February 7th, and it's at the Global Lounge at 7 p.m., and students are also welcome to come to our meetings if they're interested in getting involved. We meet every Friday in Geography 215B from 4 to 5 p.m. And it's really just a place for everyone, no matter if they have been interested for a long time, they just became interested, whatever their skill set is, to just be involved in the conversation.
Okay, thank you so much for your time, Jory.
Thank you. No, it was a pleasure to be here and to talk about this issue, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Sahar. Next up, we have News 101 reporters Rohit Joseph, Sharon Nadim, and Andrew Seale's segment from the demonstration at the Peace Arch on the Canada-US border in the wake of the Trump travel ban.
But first, we're going to take a quick PSA break. Stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Oh, man.
What?
I really wanted to catch that football game, but I have to clean my room. I'm so bummed.
Yo, man, totally chill out. You can catch it on CITR.
CITR?
Did someone say CITR?
Yeah.
CITR Radio brings you Thunderbird Sports on the weekends. Catch all the action and don't miss a moment of play with our live play-by-play and color commentary. Only on CITR 101.9 FM.
Wow, that's great.
And if you can't catch the game, tune in at 3:30 p.m. every Thursday for our weekly update on UBC Athletics with live scores, recaps, and in-depth analysis.
Oh, okay, dude. Okay, dude. We get it.
Dude!
Only on CITR.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Now we are going to News 101 reporters Rohit Joseph, Sharon Nadim, and Andrew Seale's segment from the demonstration at the Peace Arch on the Canada-US border in the wake of the Trump travel ban.
Hannah would really like to hear you respond to what she has to say. How old are you?
Five.
And what's your name?
Betty.
Okay, Betty wants to hear you respond to her chant. Are you ready?
Yes! Love, not hate. Make America great. Make America great.
Make America great.
Love, not hate.
Make America great.
Love, not hate.
Make America great.
Betty was just one among thousands of American citizens that protested across the country against Donald Trump's recent executive order barring citizens from seven Muslim-majority countries. One of the protests was pretty close to home.
Where are we right now?
We're in Peace Arch Park, which is just north of Bellingham. I'm just north of Blaine, actually, in Bellingham. And it's on the border between Canada and the United States, so we're equally distance between the entry points for both countries. Mm-hmm. And so it's a great place for people on both sides of the border to come and make their views known.
Hundreds of protesters gathered around the Peace Arch, pausing their chants only to make way for speeches.
Trump's executive orders that he signed last week, his insistence on having a war on sanctuary cities, his Muslim ban, the wall that he claims that he is still going to build is not just anti-Muslim, it is not just anti-immigrant, it is anti-American. Inside this Peace Arch, there is a sign that say, "May these gates never close," and that is what we have to stand up to do to make sure that our gates do not close to the people who are coming here who need our help.
We asked a protester why she was there.
I'm here because I think Mr. President Trump has made some really poor judgments in trying to eliminate certain immigrant groups from our country. Our country was based on immigrant power, and this is really a step way, 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 way back. I think it reflects his personal fears, perhaps, and the fears of other people in the United States. And I am not one of those people who wants to be afraid of someone who comes from another country. I think they come with many, many great talents and basically are very nice people.
The conversation continued.
Why is diversity important for you?
I'm first generation on my dad's side. He's from South America. My mom is several generations here from Eastern Europe. And I myself am gay. And so diversity has always been a big part of my life and acceptance of that. Yeah.
How about for the rest of you, if you have the same kind of personal connection to diversity?
Well, yeah. Well, I'm a Muslim myself. So, I mean, Bellingham is not very diverse, but it's very understanding and very liberal, and I love that about the place.
How about for you?
My father immigrated when I was about 9 from South Africa. I'm Jewish, and my husband's Muslim. So there's just, yeah, diversity runs deep, and I think that we need to be open to all people coming into the United States. That's what we were founded on, and I think that we need to really respect that.
I lived in an all-white neighborhood growing up in Decatur, Illinois, and when I got bused into the black neighborhoods, that was a great experience for me.
Why is that?
Because I had only met one black person before. I mean, and at that point, I got to meet all these people that contradicted the views of a lot of the older people that had talked to me about race issues. It was still Jim Crow. Which, do you know what Jim Crow is?
Yeah.
Well, there were still Jim Crow signs up in the smaller towns around Decatur, not in Decatur, but around Decatur when I was growing up. And I'm 65. So it's not that long ago that was happening. And it opened my eyes, and I was just really happy to have that experience, and it enriched my life.
What do you think should be done next, or what can everybody do?
Every day I've been either calling my senators or representatives and telling them to vote against a nominee for some cabinet position, particularly Betsy DeVos, Secretary of Education. I've written letters to the editor in the Weekly. If I hear about any more of these kinds of gatherings, I'll come to them. And I'm really, really hoping, I've given money to causes that I never have before. I've subscribed to the New York Times, which I think is a wonderful newspaper and does not lie, as Mr. Trump would like us to believe.
Bellingham is a sanctuary city, but they're trying to improve the level of sanctuary in that city now.
Mm-hmm. With the recent defunding to sanctuary cities, are you worried about that at all? Or
if you don't fight for your freedom, you don't deserve it. We are willing, we are very willing to fight for our freedoms.
Staying active, taking turns, maybe taking a break because we're all pretty tired and feel pretty beaten down. I have a roommate who's a Syrian, and she couldn't make it today because it's too close to home. So just taking time to support each other and being active.
This land is your land, this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I was walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
Thank you, Rohit and Sharon. Next up is News 101 co-director Andrew Seale's interview with Chris Arsenault, visiting professor in forestry issues at UBC's School of Journalism.
Hi, Chris.
Hey, Andrew.
Thanks for talking. All right. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Andrew.
Thanks for talking to us today. So you're the visiting professor in forestry issues here at the School of Journalism. Can you just tell us a bit about why you're here?
Certainly. Well, thanks for having me on, Andrew. I guess the key thing I want to be, and I will be talking about at UBC, is what's happening with the world's largest tropical forest today. We all grew up hearing about the Amazon, hearing about deforestation and tree cutting for cattle ranching. So the point of these lectures is to put forestry issues in an international context and look at what's happening with what's essentially the lungs of the planet and the victories and the problems facing the Amazon today.
Recently, at least in the past couple of years, we've been hearing that there's been some progress being made regarding, you know, declining deforestation rates, but Brazil's in the midst of a recession right now, so what's going on? Is that having an impact?
Yeah, absolutely. So deforestation peaked in 2004. About nearly a fifth of the Amazon has already been lost. So that's an area twice as large as Poland, and that's been irreparably deforested and harmed. The rate of cutting has fallen pretty markedly by about 70%. Since 2004, and there's been a really significant push by the Brazilian government, by international foundations, by journalists and forestry experts to try to tackle this problem. In the last year or 18 months, though, the rate has increased again. So there was about 7,000 square kilometers of forests destroyed in 2015, the latest numbers available. That's an area roughly the size of Brunei, and that's an increase over the previous years. So I think Brazil should be commended for its long-term progress in slowing the cutting, but there are worrying signs on the agenda with the rate increasing again and a whole series of new pieces of environmental legislation that the current government has proposed, which critics and scientists say will further hurt the efforts to preserve the rainforest.
So with Brazil being a developing country with a struggling economy, what can they do? Obviously, it's not so simple as saying, let's just stop chopping down all the trees.
Well, I mean, it isn't quite that simple, but they have committed to zero net deforestation by 2030. So it's not so far off on that. The interesting thing is that the serious agriculture producers, Brazil's the world's largest exporter of beef, of coffee, of oranges, and the big producers, the big domestic ones, aren't needing to clear more land for their operations. They're using land that's already been cleared. There's ample room to scale up production on land that's already been cleared and manage it more efficiently. No one disputes their right to boost growth and the need to lift people out of poverty, which has happened pretty successfully up until the recession about 3 years ago. But that can quite easily been done without cutting down more of the forest. There's plenty of examples. JBS, the world's largest meat exporting company, Brazilian firm, they've committed to zero deforestation, as has the largest grocery store chain in that country, Pão de Açúcar. So there are examples of business taking this more seriously. The real culprit here are essentially shady local business bosses and a few other companies who are continuing this trend. It's a short-sighted economic position, and it actually doesn't generate that many long-term jobs. This is sustainable management and scaling up production. That's how you boost growth and preserve the forest.
In places like British Columbia, where they've done a lot of logging and where it's a big industry, one of the criticisms is that when they replant the forests, it doesn't grow back in the same way. Of course, if you chop down an old growth forest, it's not going to become an old growth forest again. Is there any drives in Brazil to reclaim or reforest some of these areas, and how would that work? Is it possible?
Yeah, I mean, there has been some. The Atlantic rainforest gets a lot less press than the Amazon. That's the rainforest that's closer to Rio de Janeiro, where I'm based, and only 7% of that forest is left standing. So the vast majority has been already destroyed. There have been some efforts to replant. But going back to your earlier question about balancing economic growth and forests, I think what most people are saying, and I tend to agree with this, is that the areas that have already been cut down, tree planting, for example, in Brazil, isn't really a job the way it is in Canada for, say, young university students. So what I would say is for that land that's already been cleared, deal with the soil, use that land for agriculture, and focus on preserving the forests that are already there. And that's the better way for dealing with growth. In terms of, there are some reforestation issues. Most reforestation program is mostly run by NGOs, but to be frank, they're quite marginal.
All right, thank you. And so you're giving a talk this coming Wednesday. What do students need to know, and why should they attend?
I think the Amazon is just awesome in its own regard. I think it may sound simplistic, but I just think that the majesty and just the utter amazingness of this resource is something that's worth preserving and worth knowing about on its own term. If you want to get into it more deeply, I mean, there's a paper published in the last 6 months, a peer-reviewed study argues that the fourth industrial revolution could be fueled by plants and other living creatures from the Amazon that we haven't even discovered yet or don't even know what to do with them. And if the forests are cut, that won't happen. And I guess what I want to impart to students is there is, a little bit tangential, but there is a BC connection to some of this stuff in terms of where pension funds from BC are invested. And in one case I've looked at, some of those funds were used to buy a large swath of land just north of the Amazon in the Cerrado, which displaced local residents and which essentially put BC pensioners into bed with a very shady local businessman in Brazil. So there is that connection in terms of land grabs and our money, which is worth exploring. But I really think the Amazon in its own right is fascinating, and the role that consumers and journalists and just regular Vancouverites can play in knowing about this and moving conservation efforts forward, I think is valuable.
Awesome. Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Great to talk to you, Andrew. And the talk is at UBC Robson Square in the HSBC Hall. And that's on Wednesday, February 8th. Drinks are at 6:30, and the talk starts at 7. And it should be fun.
Great. We'll see you there.
Take care.
Thank you, Andrew. We're now going to News 101 reporter Kithana Sasidharan on the scene report from the vigil for the victims of the Quebec attack.
I am standing outside Al Jamia Mosque as they host a vigil tonight for the victims of the Quebec mosque shooting on January 29th, where six people have been pronounced dead. Gathered here with many members of the Muslim community are close to 100 people so far, and many of them from other ethnic and religious communities, from young children to seniors. Vancouverites have come to grieve this loss and huddle together in solidarity with Vancouver's Muslim community. Amidst the darkening sky, the candlelights illuminate the faces of those in attendance. Flowers have been placed by the doorway of the mosque. Tears well up in the eyes of those who listen to the sentiments being shared tonight about equality and love. Haroon Khan, trustee, has expressed appreciation for the Vancouverites who have come out to this vigil. One by one, leaders of other religious institutions spoke in support of religious freedom and kindness to all. Mayor Robertson is expected to arrive shortly. This Saturday, the mosque will be holding another vigil at 5:30 p.m. as it corresponds with the National Day of Action. For Thunderbird News, I'm Krithana Sasitharan.
Thank you, Kitana. It's now time for Alex Norman's financial report, our last segment of the night.
This is the weekly financial update report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets. These are this week's top stories for Thursday, January 26th to Thursday, February 2nd, 2017. Another Tundra Energy oil spill reported in southern Saskatchewan. Starbucks plans to hire 10,000 refugees worldwide over the next 5 years. Vancouver home sales plunged 39.5% amidst lukewarm starts in 2017. And Uber CEO steps down from Donald Trump's business advisory group. We begin this week's news with the National Energy Board's investigation into a second spill from a Tundra Energy Limited pipeline in less than a month. Alarms went off at a Tundra Energy station near South Oak, Saskatchewan, early Tuesday afternoon when 5,000 liters of oil was leaked from the Westboro pipeline. There were no injuries, there was no fire, there was no one evacuated, and there were no threats to public safety, said the National Energy Board spokesman Tom Nurfer in the latest incident. Tundra Energy is still dealing with a 2,000-liter pipeline spill discovered on January 20th on the Ocean Man's First Nation territory. That spill is still under investigation by the Saskatchewan government, which is still trying to determine why the pipeline's leak detection system did not flag the leak. The government also determined the pipeline was nearly 50 years old and there were no records of it ever being inspected by provincial authorities. Starbucks stirs up controversy with its latest plans to hire. Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz said on Sunday that the company plans to hire 10,000 refugees over the next 5 years in 75 countries. This comes 2 days after the U.S. President Donald Trump's executive order banning refugees from certain countries. Starbucks, in a letter from Schultz, told employees that he would do everything possible to support affected workers. The hiring efforts announced on Sunday would start in the United States by initially focusing on individuals who have served with U.S. troops as interpreters and other support personnel in various countries. Schultz will be stepping down as CEO in a few months to focus on a new high-end coffee shop. He will be handing the top job to Chief Operating Officer Kevin Johnson, a longtime technology executive. Johnson will become the executive chairman of Starbucks in April. Shares in Starbucks were down this week, closing on Thursday for a 7.85% loss. Vancouver is cooling off, and it's not because of the weather. Home sales in Metro Vancouver dropped by almost 40% last month compared to the year before, with sales in detached houses falling the hardest. The Real Estate Board of Greater Vancouver says the condominium market is currently more active in sales than for detached houses. Just over 15,000 residential properties were sold in January, down 39.5% from the approximate 2,500 sales that were recorded in January 2016. Board President Dan Morris says there has been a lukewarm start to the year. Quote, while we saw near record-breaking sales this time last year, home buyers and sellers are more reluctant to engage so far in 2017, he said in a statement. The benchmark price for detached properties was about $1.5 million in January, down 6.6% over the last 6 months. Trump is losing a business advisor, and I don't think he's uber pumped about it. Uber Technologies CEO Travis Kalanick says he's leaving U.S. President Donald Trump's business advisory group. The CEO of the ride-hailing service has been under mounting pressure from activists who oppose the administration's immigration policies. Critics include Uber drivers, many whom are immigrants themselves. Social media campaigns have been targeting Uber, urging its users to delete its accounts and opt for rival Lyft. Uber has been emailing its users who have deleted their accounts to say they share their concerns and will compensate drivers affected by the ban. Quote, joining the group was not meant to be an endorsement of the president or his agenda, but unfortunately it has been misconstrued to be exactly that, said Kalanick. An Uber spokeswoman later confirmed that he had left the group. In other market news, these are this week's numbers. Toronto's S&P TSX Composite Index was down this week, posting a loss of 1.39% to close at 15,399 points on Thursday. The broader S&P 500 Index was also down this week, posting a loss of 0.7% to close at 2,228 points on Thursday. The Nasdaq closed on Thursday with a loss of 0.33% for the week. In the European markets, the German DAX closed down 1.9%. In the Asian indices, the Japanese Nikkei posted a loss of 2.37%, and the Shanghai Composite Index was up 1.27%. In the commodities market, gold futures closed up this week to close at $1,213 an ounce, while the March crude futures were also up this week 0.22% to close at $53.38 a barrel. In natural gas, March future contracts were down 6.68% to close at $3.17 a unit. In the bond market, yields for 10-year Canadian bonds are currently at 1.766%. U.S. 10-year Treasury yields closed higher this week at a rate of 2.48%. This has been the weekly financial update report with Alex Norman. Keep you updated with what's going on in the markets.
Thank you, Alex. That's our program for February 3rd. Today's newscast was brought to you by talented volunteer efforts. If you would like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our Facebook, Twitter, or email us at news@citr.ca.
You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/radio/news/101. You can also find great content on our SoundCloud and Mixcloud pages. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Andrew Seal.
And I'm Sharon Nadeem. Today's broadcast was produced by Seher Asaf and Andrew Seal. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening.
After this next segment, stay tuned for Sean Harbottle's Hippity Hoppity Brigade at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM.